but the contract was legally airtight. There was nothing the lawyer could do about it. But, as Darryl explained, he took pity on the woman and gave the motorhome ownership back to the couple. It sounded like an amazing operation. However, nobody can guarantee you 54% on your money, ever. Bernie Madoff, the currently incarcerated Ponzi-scheming money manager in the U.S., promised a minimum return of 10% annually, and he sucked scores of intelligent people into his self-servicing vacuum cleaner, absconding with $65 billion in the process. He claimed to be making money for his clients by investing their cash, mostly in the stock market, but he just paid them interest with new investors' deposits. The account balances that his clients saw weren't real. When an investor wanted to withdraw money, Madoff took the proceeds from fresh money that was deposited by other investors. When the floor finally fell out from underneath Madoff during the 2008 financial crisis, investors lost everything. His victims included actors Kevin Bacon, his wife Kira Sedgwick, and director Steven Spielberg, among the many others who lost millions with Madoff. Yet the percentages paid by Madoff were chicken feed compared with the 54% caviar reaped by Darryl Klein's investors. Despite the solid-sounding story Darryl told me back in 2001, I still wouldn't invest money with the guy. But my friend kept receiving his interest payments, which now exceeded $100,000. By 2003, I had seen enough. My friend had been making money off this guy for years, and my spidey senses were tickled more by greed than danger. I met with Darryl again, and I invested $7,000. Then I convinced an investment club that I was in to dip a toe in the water. So we did, investing $5,000. The monthly 4.5% interest checks were making us feel pretty smart. After a year, the investment club added another $20,000. Other friends were also tempted by the easy money. One friend took out a loan for $50,000 and plunked it down on Instacash loans, and he began receiving $2,250 a month in interest from the company. Another friend deposited more than $100,000 into the business. He was paid $54,000 in yearly interest. But Alice's wonderland was more real than our fool's paradise. Like Bernie Madoff, who was caught after Darryl, the party eventually ended in 2006, and the carnage was everywhere. We never found out whether Darryl intended for his business to be a Ponzi scheme from the beginning. He was clearly paying interest to investors from the deposits of other investors, or whether his business slowly unraveled after a well-intentioned but ineffective business plan went awry. Klein was eventually convicted of breaching the Provincial Securities Act, preventing him from engaging in investor relations activities until 2026. The fact that he was slapped on the wrist, however, was small consolation for his investors. A few had even remortgaged their homes to get in on the action. Our investment club, after collecting interest for just a few months, lost the balance of our $25,000 investment. My $7,000 personal investment also evaporated. Many investors in the company lost everything. My friend who borrowed $50,000 to invest collected interest for 10 months, which he had to pay taxes on, before seeing his investment balance disappear when Instacash loans went bankrupt in 2006. It's an important lesson for investors to learn. At some point in your life, someone is going to make you a lucrative promise. Give it a miss. In all likelihood, it's going to cause nothing but headaches, not to mention a potential black hole in your bank account. Investment newsletters and their track records. In 1999, the same investment club mentioned earlier was trying to get an edge on its stock picking. We purchased an investment newsletter subscription called the Gilder Technology Report, www.gildertech.com, published by a guy named George Gilder. Unbelievably, he is still in business. A quick online search today reveals a website that exhorts his stock picks, claiming his portfolio returned 155% during the past 3 years, and that if you buy now, you'll pay just $199 for the 12-month online subscription to his newsletter. If you're falling for that promotional garbage, I have a story for you. Back in 1999, we were convinced that George Gilder held the keys to the kingdom of wealth. Unfortunately for us, he was the king of pain. Today, if George Gilder reported his 11-year track record online instead of trying to tempt investors with an unaudited 3-year historical return, he would have a stampede of exiters. His stock picks have been abysmal for his followers. We bought the George Gilder Technology Report in 1999, and we put real money down on his suggestions. I'm just hoping my investment club buddies don't read this book and learn that George Gilder is still hawking his promises of wealth. They'd probably want to send him down a river in a barrel. Back in Chapter 4, I showed you a chart of technology companies and how far their share prices fell from 2000 to 2002. In 2000, whose investment report recommended purchasing Nortel Networks, www.nortel.com, Lucent Technologies, www.alcatel-lucent.com, JDS Uniphase, www.jdsu.com, and Cisco Systems, www.cisco.com. You guessed it, George Gilder's. Table 8.1 puts the reality in perspective. If you had a total of $40,000 invested in the above four Gilder-touted businesses in 2000, it would have dropped to $1,140 by 2002. And how much would your investment have to gain to get back to $40,000? Table 8.1. Prices of technology stocks plummet, 2000 to 2002. Amazon.com. High value in 2000, $10,000. Low value in 2002, $700. Cisco Systems, $10,000, $990. Corning Inc., $10,000, $100. JDS Uniphase, $10,000, $50. Lucent Technologies, $10,000, $70. Nortel Networks, $10,000, $30. Priceline.com, $10,000, $60. Yahoo, $10,000, $360. Source, Morningstar and Burton Malkiel's A Random Walk Guide to Investing. In percentage terms, it would need to grow 3,400%. Wow, wouldn't that be a headline for the Gilder Technology Report today? Since 2002, our stock picks have made 3,400%. If that really happened, George Gilder would be advertising those numbers on his site rather than showcasing a measly return of 155% over the past 3 years. George Gilder's stock picks have tossed investors into the Grand Canyon, and he's bragging that his investors have scaled back about 50 feet. He could tell the truth about his real stock-picking prowess, but then he couldn't fool newsletter subscribers looking for keys to easy wealth. There are no keys to easy wealth, so don't be fooled by advertised claims. Just for fun, let's assume that Gilder's original stock picks from 2000 did make 3,400% from 2002 to 2011. That might impress a lot of people, but it wouldn't impress me. After the losses that Gilder's followers experienced from 2000 to 2002, a gain of 3,400% would have his long-term subscribers barely breaking even on their original investment after a decade. And that's if you didn't include the ravages of inflation. If there are any long-term subscribers, they're nowhere near their break-even point. Can you hear his followers scrambling on the lowest slopes of the Grand Canyon? I wonder if they're thirsty. Where there is a buck to be taken. We already know that the odds of beating a diversified portfolio of index funds after taxes and fees are slim. But what about investment newsletters? You can find more beautifully marketed newsletter promises than you can find people in a Tokyo subway. They selectively boast returns, like Gilder does, creating mouth-watering temptations for many inexperienced investors. With our special strategy, we've made 300% over the past 12 months in the stock market. And now, for just $9.99 a month, we'll share this new wealth-building formula with you. Think about it. If somebody really could compound money 10 times faster than Warren Buffett, wouldn't she be at the top of the Forbes 400 list? And if she did have the stock market in the palm of her hand, why would she want to spend so much time banging away at her computer keyboard so she could sell $9.99 subscriptions to you? Let's look at the real numbers, shall we? Most newsletters are like dragonflies. They look pretty, they buzz about, but sadly they don't live very long. In a 12-year study from June 1980 to December 1992, professors John Graham at the University of Utah and Campbell Harvey at Duke University tracked more than 15,000 stock market newsletters. In their findings, 94% went out of business sometime between 1980 and 1992. If you have the Midas touch as a stock picker who spreads pearls of financial wisdom in a newsletter, you're probably not going to go out of business. If you can deliver on the promise of high annual returns, you'll build a newsletter empire. If no one, however, wants to read what you have to say because your results are terrible, the newsletter follows the sad demise of the woolly mammoth. There are several organizations that track the results of financial newsletter stock picks, and the Hulbert Financial Digest is one of them. In its January 2001 edition, the U.S.-based publication revealed it had followed 160 newsletters that it had considered solid. But of the 160 newsletters, only 10 of them had beaten the stock market indexes with their recommendations over the past decade. Based on that statistic, the odds of beating the stock market indexes by following an investment newsletter are less than 7%. Put another way, how would this advertisement grab you? You could invest with a total stock market index fund, or you could follow our newsletter picks. Our odds of failure compared with the index are 93%. Sign up now. If investors knew the truth, financial newsletters probably wouldn't exist. High-yielding bonds called junk. At some point, you might fight the temptation to buy a corporate bond paying a high interest percentage. It's probably best to avoid that kind of investment. If a company is financially unhealthy, it's going to have a tough time borrowing money from banks. So it advertises a high interest rate to draw riskier investors. But here's the rub. If the business gets into financial trouble, it won't be able to pay that interest. What's worse, you could even lose your initial investment. Bonds paying high interest rates, because they have shaky financial backing, are called junk bonds. I've found that being responsibly conservative is better than stretching over a ravine to pluck a pretty flower. Fast-growing markets can make bad investments. A friend of mine once told me, my advisor suggested that because I'm young, I could afford to have all of my money invested in emerging market funds. His financial planner dreamed of the day when billions of previously poor people in China or India would worship their 500-inch flat-screen televisions watching The Biggest Loser while stuffing their faces with burgers, fries, and gallons of Coke. Eyes sparkle at the prospective burgeoning profits made by investing in fattening economic waistlines. But there are a few things to consider. Historically, the stock market investment returns of fast-growing economies don't always beat the stock market growth of slow-growing economies. William Bernstein, using data from Morgan Stanley's Capital Index and the International Monetary Fund, reported in his book, The Investor's Manifesto, that fast-growing countries based on gross domestic product, GDP growth, paradoxically have produced lower historical returns than the stock markets in slower-growing economies from 1988 to 2008. Table 8.2 shows that when we take the fastest-growing economy, China's economy, and compare it with the slowest-growing economy, the U.S., we see that investors in U.S. stock indexes would have made plenty of money from 1993 to 2008. But if investors could have held a Chinese stock market index over the same 15-year period, they would not have made any profits despite China's GDP growth of 9.61% a year over that period. Table 8.2. Growing economies don't always produce great stock market returns. Table shows country, 1988 to 2008 after inflation annualized GDP growth in percentages, and average stock growth in percentages. United States, GDP growth 2.77, stock growth 8.8. Indonesia, GDP growth 4.78, stock growth 8.16. Singapore, GDP growth 6.67, stock growth 7.44. Malaysia, GDP growth 6.52, stock growth 6.48. Korea, GDP growth 5.59, stock growth 4.87. Thailand, GDP growth 5.38, stock growth 4.41. Taiwan, GDP growth 5.39, stock growth 3.75. China, GDP growth 9.61, stock growth negative 3.31 as of 1993. Source, The Investor's Manifesto by William Bernstein. Similarly, as revealed in Table 8.3, Yale University celebrated institutional investor David Swensen warns endowment fund managers not to fall into the GDP growth trap either. In his book, written for institutional investors, Pioneering Portfolio Management, he suggests from 1985, the earliest date from which the World Bank's International Finance Corporation began measuring emerging market stock returns, to 2006, the developed countries' stock markets earned higher stock market returns for investors than emerging market stocks did. Table 8.3. Emerging market investors don't always make more money. Table shows the index, the annual gain for the period 1985 to 2006, and what $100,000 invested in each index would grow to. Index, U.S. index, 13.1% annual gain, $100,000 would grow to $1,326,522.75. Developed stock market index, England, France, Canada, Australia, 12.4% annual gain. $100,000 invested would grow to $1,164,374.09. Emerging market index, Brazil, China, Thailand, Malaysia. 12% annual gain. $100,000 invested would grow to $1,080,384.82. Source, Pioneering Portfolio Management by David Swensen. Emerging markets might be exciting because they do rise like rockets, crash like meteorites, before rising like rockets again. But if you don't need that kind of excitement in your portfolio, you might be better off going with a total international stock market index fund instead of adding a large emerging market component. Whether the emerging markets prove to be future winners is anyone's guess. They might, but it's wise to temper expectations with historical realities just in case. Gold isn't an investment. Our education systems have done such a lousy job teaching us about money that you can conduct a little experiment out on the streets that I guarantee will deliver shocking results. Walk up to an educated person and ask them to imagine that one of their forefathers bought $1 worth of gold in 1801. Then ask what they think it would be worth in 2011. Their eyes might widen at the thought of the great things they could buy today if they sold that gold. They might imagine buying a yacht or Gulfstream jet or their own island in the South China Sea. Then, break their bubble with the revelation in Figure 8.1. Selling that gold would give them enough money to fill the gas tank of a minivan. Figure 8.1. Gold versus U.S. stocks, 1801 to 2011. Gold versus U.S. stocks, growth of $1 invested from 1801 to 2011. Gold, $73. Stocks, $10,150,000. $1 invested in gold in 1801 would only be worth about $73 by 2011. How about $1 invested in the U.S. stock market? Now you can start thinking about your yacht. $1 invested in the U.S. stock market in 1801 would be worth $10.15 million by 2011. Gold is for hoarders expecting to trade glittering bars for stale bread after a financial Armageddon. Or it's for people trying to time gold's movements by purchasing it on an upward bounce with the hopes of selling before it drops. That's not investing. It's speculating. Gold has jumped up and down like an excited kid on a pogo stick for more than 200 years, but after inflation, it hasn't gained any long-term elevation. I prefer the tropical beach approach. 1. Buy assets that have proven to run circles around gold. Rebalance stock and bond indexes would do. 2. lay in a hammock on a tropical beach. 3. Soak in the sun and patiently enjoy the long-term profits. What you need to know about investment magazines. If investment magazines were altruistically created to help you achieve wealth, you'd have the same cover story during every issue. Buy index funds today. But nobody would buy the magazines. It wouldn't be newsworthy. Plus, magazines don't make much money from subscriptions. They make the majority of their money from ads. Pick up a finance magazine and thumb through it to see who's advertising. The financial service industry, selling mutual funds and brokerage services, is the biggest source of advertisement revenue. Few editors would go out on a tree branch to broadcast the futility of picking mutual funds that will beat the market indexes. Advertisers pay the bills for financial magazines. That's why you see magazine covers suggesting the hot mutual funds to buy for 2011. When I wrote an article in 2005 for Money Sense magazine titled How I Got Rich on a Middle Class Salary, I mentioned the millionaire mechanic Russ Perry, who I introduced to you in Chapter 1. I quoted Russ's opinion on buying new cars, that it wasn't a good idea, and that people should buy used cars instead. Based on a conversation I had with Ian McGuggan, the magazine's editor, I learned that one of America's largest automobile manufacturers called McGuggan on the phone and threatened to pull its advertisements if it saw anything like that in Money Sense again. There are bigger forces at play than those wanting to educate you in the financial magazine industry. I have an April 2009 issue of Smart Money magazine on my desk as I'm writing this. It would have been written a month earlier when the stock market was reeling from the financial crisis. Instead of shouting out, "Buy stocks now at a great discount," the magazine was giving people what they wanted. A front cover showing a stack of $100 bills secured by a chain and padlock with the screaming headlines, "Protect Your Money," "5 Strong Bond Funds," "Where to Put Your Cash," and "How to Buy Gold Now." Think about it. They have to. If the general public is scared stiff of the stock market's drop, they'll want high doses of chicken soup for their knee-jerking souls. They'll want to know how to escape from the stock market, not embrace it. Giving the public what it pines for when they're scared might sell magazines. But you can't make money being fearful when others are fearful. I don't mean to pick on Smart Money magazine. I can only imagine the dilemma it faced when putting that issue together. Its writers are smart people. They know, especially for long-term investors, that buying into the stock market when it's on sale is a powerful wealth-building strategy. But a falling stock market for most people is scarier than a rectal examination. Touting bond funds and gold was an easier sell for the magazine. Let's have a look at the kind of money you would have made if you followed that April 2009 edition of Smart Money. It suggested placing your investment in the following bond funds. The Osterweis Strategic Income Fund, www.osterweis.com/default.asp?P. The T. Rowe Price Tax-Free Income Fund, www.3trowepricecom/FB2/FBKweb/snapshot.do?TICKER=PRTAX. The Janus High Yield Fund, https://www.janus.com/janus/retail/fund-detail?fund-capital-ID=14. The Templeton Global Bond Fund, www.franklintempleton.com/retail/app/products/views/fund_page.jsf?NUMBER=406. And the Dodge and Cox Income Fund, www.dodgeandcox.com/incomefund.asp. Table 8.4 shows that with reinvesting the interest, Smart Money's recommended bond funds would have returned an average of 32.8% from April 2009 to January 2011. Table 8.4. Percentages of growth, April 2009 through January 2011. Smart Money's recommended bond funds. Osterweis Strategic Income Fund, plus 34%. T. Rowe Price Tax-Free Income Fund, plus 13%. Janus High Yield Fund, plus 58%. Templeton Global Bond Fund, plus 34%. Dodge & Cox Income Fund, plus 25%. Average return, plus 32.8%. Source, Morningstar. How about gold, which was also recommended by that edition of Smart Money? Its spectacular run would have seen it gain 46% during the same period, as gold was hitting an all-time high. So far, it looks like the magazine was right on the money, until you look at what they didn't headline. Stock prices were cheaper relative to business earnings than they had been in decades. The magazine headline should have read, "Buy stocks now." Because they didn't, as demonstrated by Figure 8.2, smart money readers missed out on some huge gains, as stocks easily beat bonds and gold from April 2009 to January 2011. Figure 8.2, Bond Funds and Gold versus Stocks, April 2009 through January 2011. Smart Money's recommendations fall short. Bonds, 32.8%. Gold, 46%. World Stock Index, 70%. Source, Morningstar. The U.S. stock market, as measured by Vanguard's U.S. Stock Market Index, increased 69%. Vanguard's International Stock Market Index rose by 70%, and Vanguard's Total World Index rose by 70% during the same period. The comparative results punctuate how tough predictions can be, while emphasizing that magazines cater for their advertisers and their readers' emotions to sell magazines. Hedge funds, the rich stealing from the rich. Some wealthy people turn their noses up at index funds, figuring that if they pay more money for professional financial management, they'll reap higher rewards in the end. Take hedge funds, for example. As the investment vehicle for many wealthy accredited investors, those deemed rich enough to afford taking large financial gambles, hedge funds capture headlines and tickle greed buttons around the world, despite their hefty fees. But by now, it probably comes as no surprise that, statistically, investing with index funds is a better option. Hedge funds can be risky, and the downside of owning them outweighs the upside. First, the upside. With no regulations to speak of, other than keeping middle-class wage earnings on the sidelines, hedge funds can bet against currencies or bet against the stock market. If the market falls, a hedge fund could potentially make plenty of money if the fund manager shorts the market, by placing bets that the markets will fall and then collecting on these bets if the markets crash. With the gift of having accredited, supposedly sophisticated investors only, hedge fund managers can choose to invest heavily in a few individual stocks, or any other investment product for that matter, while a regular mutual fund has regulatory guidelines with a maximum number of eggs they're allowed to put into any one basket. If a hedge fund manager's big bets pay off, investors reap the rewards. Now for the downside. The typical hedge fund charges 2% of the investor's assets annually as an expense ratio, which is one-third more expensive than the expense ratio of the average U.S. mutual fund. Then the hedge fund's management takes 20% of their investors' profits as an additional fee to generate profits for fund managers or for the business offering the fund. It's a license to print money off the backs of those hoping for high rewards. Hedge funds voluntarily report their results, which is the first phase of mist over the industry. The Economist reports the average unaudited returns of hedge funds on the back of each issue, comparing the results to various world indexes. I have been scanning the results for a decade or more, and generally the hedge funds compare favorably from what I have seen by a consistent percentage or two above the indexes. But hedge fund data collectors don't crunch the numbers for the hedge funds that go out of business. They only report the results of those that remain. So what's the attrition rate for these investment products? When Princeton University's Burton Malkiel and Yale School of Management's Robert Ibbotson conducted an 8-year study of hedge funds from 1996 to 2004, they reported that fewer than 25% of funds lasted the full 8 years. Would you want to pick from a group of funds with a 75% mortality rate? I wouldn't. When looking at reported average hedge fund returns, you only see the results of the surviving funds. The constantly dying funds aren't factored into the averaging. It's a bit like a coach entering 20 high school kids in a district championship cross-country race. 17 drop out before they finish, but your three remaining runners take the top three spots, and you report in the school newspaper that your average runner finished second. Bizarre? Of course. But in the fantasy world of hedge fund data crunchers, it's still accurate. As a result of such Twilight Zone reporting, Malkiel and Ibbotson found during their study that the average returns reported in databases were overstated by 7.3% annually. These results include survivorship bias, not counting those funds that don't finish the race, and something called backfill bias. Imagine 1,000 little hedge funds that are just starting out. As soon as they open shop, they start selling to accredited investors. But they aren't big enough or successful enough to add their performance figures to the hedge fund data crunchers yet. After 10 years, assume that 75% of them go out of business, which is in line with Malkiel and Ibbotson's findings. For them, the dream is gone. And it's really gone for the people who invested with them. Of those, the 250 that remain, half have results of which they're proud, allowing them to grow and to boast of their successful track records. So out of 1,000 new hedge funds, 250 remain after 10 years, and 125 of them grow large enough, based on marketing and success, to report their 10-year historical gains to the data crunchers, compiling hedge fund returns. The substandard or bankrupt funds don't get number crunched. Ignoring the weaker funds and highlighting only the strongest ones is called a backfill bias. Doing so ignores the mortality of the dead funds, and it ignores the funds that weren't successfully able to grow large enough for database recognition. Malkiel and Ibbotson's study found that this bizarre selectiveness spuriously inflated hedge fund returns by 7.3% annually over the period of their study. To make matters even worse, hedge funds are remarkably inefficient after taxes, based on the frequency of their trading. Plus, you never know ahead of time which funds will survive and which funds will die a painful and costly death. Hedge funds are like hedgehogs. Nice to look at from afar, but you really don't want to get too close to their spines. You're far better off in a total stock market index fund. When investing, seductive promises and get-rich-quicker schemes can be tempting. But they remind me of why I don't take experimental shortcuts when hiking. It's too easy to lose your way. I wonder if the famous French writer Voltaire would agree. In a translation from his 1764 Dictionnaire Philosophique, he wrote, "The best is the enemy of good." Investors who aren't satisfied with a good plan, like indexing, may strive for something they hope will be best. But that path's wake is filled with more tragedies than successes. Rule 9. The 10% stock picking solution, if you really can't help yourself. Women might be better investors than men. Various studies around the globe comparing investment account returns for both men and women put women on top. Why is this? Putting women on the household investment podium doesn't make sense to a lot of men. After all, the fairer sex isn't as likely to gather around the water coolers at work, talking up the latest hot stock or mutual fund. They're not as likely to be drooling over CNBC's Becky Quick as she and her co-hosts spout off about stocks, the economy, and the markets on a daily basis. How can women's investment results beat men's results if there are fewer women taking advantage of all the ever-changing information out there? Finance professors Brad Barber and Terence Odin suggest that women's investment returns beat men's returns on average by roughly 1 percentage point annually because they trade less frequently, take fewer risks, and expect lower returns, according to a 2009 article by Jason Zweig in the Wall Street Journal. Overconfidence, it appears, might be more of a male trait than a female's. When I've given seminars on indexed investing, many of the women learn to put together a diversified portfolio of indexes. But what has been the greatest risk to their indexed accounts from what I've seen? Their husbands. Men more often run the risk of imploding their investment accounts, of chasing get-rich-quick stocks, of trying to second-guess the economy's direction, and of feeling they can take higher risks to gain higher returns. It sets up the potential for a matrimonial investment war, which might involve the need to compromise. Whether you are a man or a woman, if you really can't refrain from buying individual stocks, then set aside 10% of your investment portfolio for stock picking while keeping the remaining 90% in a diversified basket of indexes. When buying individual stocks, do it intelligently. You're not likely to beat the indexes over the long term, but you're sure to have the odd lucky streak, and you might really enjoy the process. Using Warren Buffett. In 1999, I joined a group of fellow school teachers who pooled some of their money into an investment club. We started out as a rudderless boat. Thinking we were smart, we watched the economic news, subscribed to stock-picking newsletters, followed financial websites, read the Wall Street Journal, and listened to experts on television. And like most people who follow the manic-depressive schizophrenic news of the investment media, our account got hammered. But then we became Warren Buffett disciples. Unlike the other stock market gurus we previously followed, Buffett never claims to know where stock prices are going to go over the short term. Nor does he pontificate about future interest rates or whether a certain company is going to report stronger than expected profit earnings that month, quarter, or year. What he does give us, however, is far more valuable. He teaches how to think clearly and logically about buying businesses at rational prices, suggesting that a business has an intrinsic value and that valuation could always be higher or lower than what the stock market is quoting. In other words, a stock could be worth much more than its current market price. Finding great businesses at fair prices, or better yet, at great prices, is how Buffett has made a fortune in the stock market over time, and our investment club hoped to do the same. Investment Club follows the sage. By the end of 2000, after a rough start, our investment club of school teachers was officially following the Gospel of Warren. We selected stocks based on Buffett-like criteria, and we've done well, averaging 8.3% annually from October 1999 to January 2011. In 2004, I began showing our investment holdings and results to Ian McGuggan, then editor of Money Sense. In 2008, he suggested we go public with the story, and I wrote about the club's results and methodology in the November 2008 issue of the magazine. Since 2008, our club's investments have continued to perform well. But here's the most important part. We don't have any illusions that we will beat the stock market indexes over the long haul. Time has an eroding effect on anyone bold enough to consider beating an index. Loads of smarter investors than us have outperformed the market for a number of years, only to be force-fed a piece of humble pie when they've made a wrong move. Lance Armstrong, the 7-time winner of the Tour de France, wasn't able to keep winning the world's greatest race, as much as he wanted to. And most investors, no matter how they might initially dominate, eventually get spanked by a diversified portfolio of indexes. For that reason, all of my retirement money is tucked away in indexes. That said, if you're still tempted to battle the stock market indexes yourself, let me share what lessons we have learned. Just remember this, no matter what kind of early results you achieve, don't get romanced by the notion that it's going to be easy to beat the market. And don't allocate more than a small portion of your portfolio to individual stocks. Commit to the stocks you buy. I don't believe most millionaires trade stocks. If they own any shares at all, I believe they buy and hold them for long periods, much like they would if they bought a business, an apartment building, or a piece of land. Numerous international studies have shown that, on average, the more you trade, the less you make after taxes and fees. So forget about the high-flying, seductive rants and quacks on CNBC's financial program Squawk Box, convincing you to react to any market hiccup. Forget about fast-paced online newsletter pontifications touting the next hot sector or trading method. Most rich people are committed to their businesses. After all, stocks are businesses, not ticker symbols online. They should be purchased with care and held for years. Two things you need to have. there are a couple of things that individual stock investors should master. For starters, they need to understand that when stock prices are falling, this is a good thing. Secondly, they need to learn how to identify a great business when they see it. Hopefully, after reading Chapter 4, you'll have the first part licked. A rising market is a pain in the backside for a long-term investor. If you're going to be buying stock market investments for at least the next 5 years, you'll prefer to see a stagnating market, or better yet, a falling one. When you've selected a great business, and when the market sends that business into a spiral, you will celebrate and buy more of it. That's what we've done with the Investment Club. If we choose a solid business, the odds of its eventual recovery are high, and short-term market fears let us take advantage of irrational prices. So, how do you identify a great business? The first thing you need to know is what you don't know. Bear with me on that paradox. Defining what you don't know can keep you from falling into the black hole of investing. Understanding what a business makes and how much money it generates in sales isn't enough. You need a strong knowledge of how the company works. Obviously, you will never know everything about an individual company. Investors in individual stocks always need to take a leap of faith, but it's much better to understand as much as you can about a business you've elected to buy. Even when a stock is really popular, such as the current technology-favored Apple, www.apple.com, if you don't intimately understand the business, it's important that you don't buy the stock. This is the reason our investment club hasn't invested in Apple shares. There's no doubt that it's an amazing business, but we don't know enough about Apple. We don't understand how it plans to keep its competitive advantage. We do know that it was practically a dead company in 2001, and we know that today it's a darling business thanks to trendy, easy-to-use products that have taken the world by storm. But we can't tell you exactly how the business works. We can't tell you what it is developing and why. We can't tell you what big visions it has for its future, and we can't tell you whether those visions will materialize. Most importantly, we can't tell whether it will continue to sell the world's most popular products a decade from now. Maintaining its popularity and technological advantage is imperative to its success. And because we can't gauge how well it can do that in the future, we're not, and probably never will be, qualified to buy Apple stock. You might be shaking your head as you hear my confession. Perhaps Apple runs within your circle of competence. Perhaps you work in the industry and you have a strong grasp on Apple's products, its future, and its internal finances. If that's the case, then fabulous. You might be fully capable of purchasing and holding Apple as an intelligent investor and business owner. But if you're technologically challenged, like I am, you might want to find more suitable investment waters to wade in. Simple businesses can ensure more predictable profits. The famous U.S. stock picker Peter Lynch, who led Fidelity's Magellan Fund, http://fundresearch.fidelity.com/mutual-funds/summary/31618410, to superb returns in the 1980s, once suggested that you should buy a business that any idiot can run, because one day an idiot will be running it. This is the way it works in business. You won't always have fabulous leaders at the helm of your favorite companies. For that reason, my investment club has always preferred businesses that are simple rather than those that are rapidly changing. Businesses that change rapidly are complicated, and they're tough for outside investors to analyze. What's more, they're usually more expensive than other businesses. Microsoft's Bill Gates suggests that tech companies should actually be cheaper than old economy businesses because of their unpredictability. Old economy refers to older blue chip industries. But they aren't. Speaking to business students at the University of Washington in 1998, he said, "I think the price to earnings multiples of technology stocks should be quite a bit lower than the multiples of stocks such as Coke and Gillette, because we, those running technology companies, are subject to complete changes in the rules." What will a technology business be doing in the future? Will it be bigger, smaller, or will it be extinct? What's a price-earnings ratio? A price-earnings ratio, P/E ratio, indicates how cheap or expensive a stock is. The quoted price of a stock alone is irrelevant. For example, a $5 stock can be more expensive than a $100 stock. Here's an example outlined in Table 9.1. Imagine two businesses, each generating $1 million in business profits each year. Business 1 is comprised of 5 million shares at $5 each. So if you were to buy the entire company, it would cost $25 million. $5 a share times 5 million shares equals $25 million. If the company's business earnings are $1 million a year, and if the price for the entire company is $25 million at $5 a share, then we know that the price of the company is 25 times greater than the firm's annual earnings. When a stock trades at a price that's 25 times greater than its annual profits, we can say the stock's P/E ratio is 25. Imagine Business 2 making annual profits of $1 million as well, with shares valued at $100 each on the stock market. Assume that the business is comprised of 20,000 shares. To buy every share, thereby owning the entire business, would cost $2 million. 20,000 shares times $100 per share equals $2 million. Because the company also generates $1 million in business earnings, we can see that at $2 million for the entire business, it's trading at 2x earnings for a P/E ratio of 2. Therefore, Business 1 is far more expensive than Business 2. Table 9.1. When a $5 stock costs more than a $100 stock. Stock price. Business 1, $5 a share. Business 2, $100 a share. Annual business profits. Business 1, $1 million. Business 2, $1 million. Number of company shares. Business 1, 5 million. Business 2, 20,000. Cost to buy the entire business. Business 1, $25 million. Business 2, $2 million. Price of stock relative to business earnings. Business 1, 25 times greater. Business 2, 2 times greater. Price to earnings ratio, Business 1, 25, Business 2, 2. When you look at today's technology companies compared with old economy businesses, you can see that the investor in tech stocks takes two types of risks. 1. They're buying businesses with low levels of future predictability. 2. They're buying businesses that are more expensive. See examples in Table 9.2. Table 9.2. Comparative P/E ratios as of January 2011. Showing P/E ratios of tech stocks, P/E ratios of old economy stocks, and old economy stocks. P/E ratio of tech stock Apple, 22. P/E ratio of old economy stock Coca-Cola, 19. P/E ratio of tech stock Oracle, 23. P/E ratio of old economy stock Walmart, 13. P/E ratio of tech stock Qualcomm, 26. P/E ratio of old economy stock General Electric, 20. P/E ratio of tech stock Agilent Technologies, 22. P/E ratio of old economy stock Altria, 13. P/E ratio of tech stock Google, 25. P/E ratio of old economy stock Johnson & Johnson, 12. Source, Yahoo Finance, price to earnings ratios as of January 2011. You can find tech companies with occasionally lower P/E ratios than older economy companies, but generally people are willing to pay higher prices for the rush of owning tech stocks, even though as an aggregate, they tend to produce lower returns than old economy stocks when all dividends are reinvested. In Jeremy Siegel's enlightening book, The Future for Investors, Why the Tried and True Beats the Bold and New, the Wharton business professor concludes an exhaustive search indicating that when investors reinvest their dividends, they're far better off buying old economy stocks than new economy tech stocks. Dividend payouts for old economy stocks tend to be higher, so when reinvested, they can automatically purchase a greater number of new shares. New shares automatically purchased with dividends means that there are now more shares to gift further dividends. The effect snowballs. This is the main reason Siegel found that history's most profitable stocks over the past 50 years have names such as ExxonMobil, www.exxonmobil.com/corporate, Johnson & Johnson, www.jnj.com, and Coca-Cola, www.coca-cola.com, instead of names such as IBM, www.ibm.com, and Texas Instruments, www.ti.com. Most investors don't realize this. They're willing to pay more for the sexiness of high-tech stocks, which is one of the reasons most patient investors in old economy stocks tend to easily beat most tech stock purchasers over the long haul. Stocks with staying power. Because you can't control a business's management decisions, you should pick stocks that are long-standing leaders in their fields. One of my investment club's best purchases was Coca-Cola in 2004. We had the good fortune to buy it at $39 a share and were confident that we were getting a great business at a fair price. The stock price, however, has risen 72% since then, dampening our enthusiasm for additional shares based on a higher P/E ratio. The reason I call it one of our best purchases is because of its durable competitive advantage, coupled with the price we paid and the near inevitability of this company making far greater business profits 20 years from now. We feel confident that we won't have to watch Coca-Cola's business operations every quarter, that the business is nearly certain to generate higher profits 5 years from now, 10 years from now, even 20 years from now. Coca-Cola, after all, has a long-standing history of making more and more money. If we take its historical business earnings and divide them into 3-year periods, we can see how consistently the company continues to grow. Table 9.3 shows Coca-Cola's earnings per share data since 1985. Table 9.3, Coca-Cola's consistent profit growth, shown by 3-year periods and average earnings per share. 1985 to 1987, average earnings per share, 26 cents. 1988 to 1990, 43 cents. 1991 to 1993, 72 cents. 1994 to 1996, $1.19. 1997 to 1999, $1.45. 2000 to 2002, $1.57. 2003 through 2005, $2.06. 2006 to 2008, $2.65. 2009 through 2010, $3.21. Source, Value Line Investment Survey, Coca-Cola. Any way you slice it, emerging markets are helping to fuel even higher profits for Coca-Cola. The case volume of sales in India, for example, reported in Coca-Cola's 2010 annual report, reveals a 17% increase from the year before, and the Southern Eurasia region reported 20% case volume growth in 2010 from a year earlier. Coca-Cola could continue to be one of the world's most predictable businesses in the future, thanks to its wide and growing customer base, its myriad of drinks under its label, and its strong competitive position. That said, there's a lot more to valuing a good business than figuring out if it will still have a competitive advantage years from now. Buy businesses that increase the price of the products they sell. You've probably already gathered that the investment game is like playing odds. There's only one guarantee. Invest in a low-cost index fund and you'll make the return of that market plus its dividends, and you'll beat the vast majority of professional investors over time. It's not foolproof. We have no idea where the markets will be 5 or 10 years from now. Still, it's the closest thing we have to a stock market guarantee. Picking individual stocks is a lot more treacherous. So how do you put the odds of success in your favor? Buy businesses that are relatively easy to run and make sure the price of those business products are going to rise with inflation. An example of a business that doesn't meet those criteria is U.S. computer maker Dell. It's a fabulous company, but it's cursed by falling prices for its computer products. Most technology companies, after all, end up selling their products at lower prices over time. Think about how much it cost for your first laptop computer and how much cheaper and better laptops are today. It's getting cheaper for companies such as Dell to make their computers, which is one reason for their lower product prices. But lowering product prices can put a strain on profit margins. In other words, when Dell sells a $1,000 computer, after taxes and manufacturing-related costs, how much money does Dell pocket? From 2001 to 2005, Dell's average net profit margin was 6.34%. The company reaped an average of $63.40 for every $1,000 sold. And from 2006 to 2010, Dell's average profit margin was 4.08%, providing just $40.80 for every $1,000 of products that were sold. Lowering product prices threatens the company's long-term profitability, making it tough for the business to record the same kind of future profits without continually pushing itself to create something better every year. A concerned PepsiCo and Coca-Cola don't need to worry about much. If you put yourself in a cryogenic chamber and woke up 20 years from now, would Dell be a household computer name? It could be, or then again, it might bite the dust like so many tech companies before it. In contrast, businesses such as Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson, and PepsiCo, www.pepsico.com, are far more likely to be market leaders in 20 years. Unlike technology-based businesses, these companies increase the prices of the products they sell partly because of consumer loyalty for their brands. They don't have as much pressure to keep coming up with a next great product, unlike most technology-based businesses. They can create a product, market it, and expect people to enjoy it many years into the future. That's not the case with tech companies, which eventually have to slash the prices of their products to attract buyers who may otherwise be attracted to a competitor's newly introduced tech gadget, creating a much tougher and arguably more competitive business environment. Learn to love low debt levels. History is full of periods of economic duress, as well as economic prosperity, and the future will have its fair share of each. Many professional stock pickers like businesses with low debt because they can weather economic storms more effectively. It makes sense. If fewer people are buying a company's product due to an economic recession, then the high debt business is going to suffer. Money they've borrowed will still saddle them with interest payments, and they will likely be forced to lay off employees or sell assets, manufacturing equipment, buildings, and land, to meet those payments. Even if they have a fairly durable competitive advantage in their field, if they have to sell off too many assets, they probably won't maintain that advantageous position for long. An example of a business without debt, which our investment club purchased in 2005, is Fastenal, www.fastenal.com. The company sells building supply materials and has successfully expanded its operation throughout the U.S. and beyond. But business slowed when a recession hit the U.S. in 2008, hammering the home construction industry. Not having long-term debt, however, ensured it didn't have to meet the bank's loan requirements. If anything, the recession could end up being a good thing for a disciplined, debt-free, or low-debt business. Such a company could acquire the assets of struggling businesses, making them even stronger when the recession ends. You can see that investors have treated Fastenal's debt-free balance sheet with plenty of respect as well. During a slowdown for building material suppliers, Fastenal shares in late 2010 should have been priced a lot lower than they were 5 years ago when the U.S. housing market was in its full bubbled boom. But Fastenal shares haven't struggled nearly as much as the company's counterparts. Figure 9.1 reveals that, as of January 2011, they were priced higher than they were 5 years previous at the height of the building boom. Some investors like to look at businesses' debt-to-equity ratio. In other words, how much debt does a company have relative to assets? That's fair enough, but I've always preferred choosing businesses, preferably with no debt at all. It's especially wise to give ourselves a margin of safety when it comes to company debt. Some people refer to good debt and bad debt. In the case of good debt, many figure that if a business can borrow money at 8%, then make 15% on that borrowed money within the business, then gain a tax credit on the loan's interest, it will come out ahead. The logic is sound, but if a company's revenue dries up during a recession, then the 8%